ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
She did a signing in Tokyo over the weekend, which again,
can you imagine if you just showed up and then Beyonce's there
die,
to signing your album?
I would have died dead.
I did see some of the photos of the fans. They
so
looked
cute.
Hysterical.
So cute.
This is Stop Everything, the show that makes you smarter about pop culture. I'm Beverly Wang, and it was a very good Friday last week because Beyoncé's new album, Act 2, Cowboy Carter, was released. And like Beyoncé herself said, this ain't a country album. It's a Beyoncé album. She's right, but there are also so many sounds and signifiers of country music. We're going to dig into that, and we're going to talk about also all the ways that it's not a country album as well, with Maria Lewis, a big welcome back to guest critic, award-winning, best-selling author, filmmaker, pop culture etymologist, elite member of the Bay Hive group chat. Welcome.
Yeehaw, baby! Pew, 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 pew! We're off to the Beyoncé rodeo!
Oh, it's so good to have you on board for this one, because I know that you are a huge fan, and yes. I know you took advantage of that long weekend.
I did. And also, the last time I was on Stop Everything, we were discussing Beyoncé's surprise album announcement.
Because it was at the Super Bowl.
It was. Mm-hmm. And then she dropped Texas Hold'em, 16 Carriages. It was very exciting. Immediately, as soon as we went off air, I was like, can you hard launch me into that episode for March 29th?
Book you in, and here you're back.
And on the Thursday, myself and a friend of mine, so Sophina Formoli from ABC Pacific, one of the country's best arts and culture writers, we got word that the album was going to be dropping at midnight Australian time, which is a little bit unusual, I guess, because the only information we had at that particular
Scraps of information.
Scraps, whispers on the streets of Melbourne, of the world, was that it was dropping March 29. But for us, that really could have been, Saturday.
That's
for
right.
All we knew. And Beyoncé famously did change the game with that digital drop. So we were waiting. We heard whispers through the Bay Hive group chat. We stayed up to midnight. The album dropped. We started listening to it immediately. It's 1 hour and 18 minutes. So by the time we finished the album, it was 1:18 a.m. And there were no song credits at that particular point across.
So you're just piecing it together.
Yes. Like, you can obviously hear there's Willie Nelson, there's Dolly Parton. I thought I could hear Tana Adderall, who's like one of my favorite post-Daddy Lessons wave of black female country artists. And obviously Miley's voice is singular. Mm-hmm. But there were no actual song specifics yet. And so you were just watching stuff come in.
So then was this a situation where fans are like hearing stuff and then sharing information, piecing it together?
Yes.
And that's part of the deep enjoyment, is it not?
When Beyoncé drops anything, right, whether it's Black is King, which was literally a soundtrack for
the
live
Lion
action.
King.
You know what I mean? It's like, who's out there, like, and the world
other
stops.
Other Beehives.
But this is the thing about Beyoncé, is she always gives us a meal. She's always giving us lots to eat, lots to process. I think she's one of pop culture's great historians or academics, maybe. She curates different sounds and history.
I've seen this album referred to as a dissertation. And I think that's right.
Correct.
Like, it's an exploration.
Yes.
Of genre, what is music, mm-hmm. artistry, and thinking also about, like, as an artist, especially a black female artist, this lane that you're put in. Because she starts the album with this incredible American Requiem, mm-hmm. right? And some of the lyrics in there are about, she was told she's too country.
Yeah.
Not country enough.
Yeah.
And so then here she is, she's like, guess what? I'm here. And all of these judgments about, what genre she could have been. She's establishing herself as, like, very country. These are the roots. And so I think there's this irony. It made me think, like, so Beyoncé in any other, like, music industry world where it wasn't so regimented, maybe she would have been a country artist to begin with, right? And not, like, kind of boxed into, well, you're black, you're female, you're young, so you need to be R&B, you need to be urban, this so-called genre, which is the opposite of country. It just already makes you think about so many things.
Beyoncé is constantly weaving the past, the present, and the future into her sounds. There's a song on this album called Levi's, which features Post Malone for some goddamn reason.
I see, okay. Of all the duets and features, to me, that's just like, That is probably one, with all due respect, that I could have done without.
Look, you know what? He's everywhere. He's guesting on everybody's albums at the moment, and that's lovely. Apparently, he's a really nice person.
Yeah,
that's
he was also in This Is Me, now with J-Lo. It's one of
Flirting
the Zodiacal
so hard.
Council.
He's also featured on Taylor Swift's
he's
upcoming album.
He's saying yes to everything, and why not?
Post Malone is everywhere, but what's interesting is he's featured on a song called Levi's, right? And Beyoncé doesn't put brands in her songs without specific intent. And back in the day when Destiny's Child were coming up, they couldn't get any support from major fashion houses or labels or brands because they were curvy country girls. And Levi's was one of the only few brands that endorsed Destiny's Child and Beyoncé and had them as brand ambassadors. They basically pioneered the Levi's low-rise jeans.
I'm thinking back to like early photo shoots of Destiny's Child, and
denim.
They were soaked in double, triple denim. Beyoncé does not forget.
She does not forget.
And this album is soaked in a lot of moments where it's like Beyoncé has not forgotten. The statement that she put out, like to count down the 10 days to the release of the album, and she talks about how
she wasn't made to feel welcome at a particular event. We know what that event is.
What is that event, Maria Lewis?
It was Country Music Awards, where she was performing Daddy Lessons, which was very clearly country song off Lemonade, which at that time was considered her magnum opus. And she performed it at the award ceremony, and she brought the Dixie Chicks with her, who had previously been banned from the ceremony. And
because they had opposed the Iraq war and George Bush. So there's these two.
They're ashamed to say that he was from Texas, was the great line. Again, Texas, Beyoncé, Chicks, all wrapped up together. And they performed essentially like a multiple duet amalgamation of several of their different songs all together. An incredible performance.
That was a great performance. Go look it up on YouTube. It's a great performance. It's joyous.
Nat Maines and Beyoncé are such strong vocalists. And so the two of them basically roaring like lions.
And there's kind of this joy that Beyoncé has in that performance that you don't see in a lot of her like super choreographed other performances. I thought she was like loose and very happy.
Well, I think she has something to prove in that particular instance. But what we know behind the scenes is that she wasn't welcomed into that space. Her mother, Tina Knowles, Miss Tina, was treated in a very specific way. And so
Don't like to hear that because Miss Tina. Come on now.
But so were the Chicks. And it was an unwelcome place for them to be in. And she, hashtag never let it go. Love that for her.
But also like there was a lot of fan backlash from country music fans as well, being like, the Chicks have no place there. Beyoncé has no place there. I read some old comments about her outfit. Like, there's a lot of misogyny going on
there. It's not on the CMA's social media. It's one of the very few performances that it is difficult to find from their official social channels. A lot of the coverage of that performance are from other people who recorded it at the time and spread it out. So it's very fascinating, but it's also like, this is what she's talking about on this album. Her hypothesis is essentially that not only has country music is black, been black, stays black, is that all music has its roots in black music. Like even the horse on this album cover, right? On Renaissance, they had this, Renee was the nickname that everybody gave to the horse
the
on
horse.
Renaissance. The horse on this album, it's a very specific type of breed that is actually born black and its coat lightens over the years with various types of pigmentation. So even just the use of this, I think it's a Lizzie Panna. I'm not a big horse girly. I was like reading this information and like mentally filing it away to bring it up and sound smart. But it was like,
it's working.
Even the use of that specific horse, everything Beyoncé is doing has an intent and a message. And she's giving you things to digest and to think about.
You mentioned the visuals. So before we get into the songs themselves, I think the visuals are such an interesting thing to pick apart because it is the follow-up to Renaissance, which has a horse on it. She's on a horse on Cowboy Carter as well. It's a color-changing horse, which is really fascinating. And Beyoncé is like dressed basically like a queen of the rodeo, right? Mm. Also red, white, and blue, American flag colors. But I think the hair is so interesting because Beyoncé, from the Grammys when we saw her, she had that, she was foreshadowing what was to come. She has this platinum white hair, which is so striking, so beautiful. Others have pointed out that it matches the mane of the horse as well perfectly. Mm-hmm. And I started thinking about Beyoncé playing with all these codes of country music, right, and signifiers. And that white blonde hair, you know, I was thinking about women in country music. Mm-hmm. What are women in country music famous for? Their hair is part of their look, their sound, everything. But I think when Beyoncé, as a black woman, puts on the white blonde hair, you know, she's pointing out that it's artifice. It's artifice for her because you notice it more distinctly because she's a black woman. But then you start thinking, well, it's artifice for everybody who puts that on. All of that is kind of like a form of costuming, which we're kind of programmed to accept it as the norm on one kind of person and not the norm on another kind of person. And I think that's so smart, the way she's playing with all of that coding and putting it on, being like, I am as country as any like white woman singer in this industry, but I haven't been accepted. I just think even the visual is fascinating.
Again, this speaks to the mastery of Beyoncé, her speaking to her professional and personal history and the way particularly black hair and black women's hair can be weaponized against and for them, depending on the situations. Her mother famously ran a beauty salon in Houston, Texas, where Beyoncé's from. It's all part of the larger story and part of the larger picture. But even the red, white, and blue that she's wearing in that particular album cover, there's a line on this album where she says, there's a lot of red in that white and blue. And it's talking about America's bloody history, you know, about all of the blood that has been shed to create this idealized version of what America is and exclusively who that is for. You know, this album was recorded over the course of nearly 5 years. The aesthetic that she was toying with was not unknown or uncommon to really long-term Beyoncé fans, because even with the denim, the cowboy hats, the nails, the hair, it has all been part of her look and part of her brand, but it's
actually been there all along.
It has.
Yeah.
You know, you heard the lyric, made all this money, but they'll never take the country out me, hot sauce in her bag, swag. But it's about where that gets segregated and what gets placed value on. If you dress a certain way as a country artist, that can be valuable. But if you're a black woman and you dress a certain way, well, that's not country.
Mm-hmm.
Said she wasn't country, now she's too country. It's this constant back and forth. And I think that's also why she said in that original statement, Beyoncé, not famous for, number one, saying a lot anymore textually, let alone on Instagram with those long captions. When she said this isn't a country album, this is a Beyoncé album, she is correct. This isn't a clear, clean cut country album. It has rock, it has trap, it has R&B. Some of the artists featured on it are country trap artists. Even a song like Ya Ya has Nancy Sinatra in there. It has the Beach Boys reference. It has Chuck Berry. She's pulling in all of American quote unquote music into that space. Even things like the Beatles, there's a Blackbird cover on there, right? The Beatles were famous for essentially appropriating the American sound. They wrote a song about black women. It was about, you know, the Little Rock women. And then what does Beyoncé do? She has 4 black female country artists singing on that cover with her.
Yeah, there's so much education happening in this album, which is really interesting. One of the feature people that she highlights is a woman named Linda Martell. Mm. I didn't know who Linda Martell was until this album came out. And then, as always happens, all these feature articles come out. Who is Linda Martell? Mm. And, you know, all this hidden history. And Linda Martell was the first black female country artist to release a major release in 1970. She only released one album that had hits. She was the first black woman artist to perform at the Grand Ole Opry, which is like the pinnacle of country music performance. Yet we don't know her until we hear about her on this album. And then, like so many, like the 4 women featured in Blackbird, you know, just as a side note, like those lyrics then get so much more layered, you know, Blackbird Fly, Blackbird, all of this. It's like she's obviously talking about the women and the singing and their careers along with all of that layered history in the original song. But like everything is like teachable moment sounds kind of dorky, but there are all these moments where you can educate yourself. And if you go and you look at Linda Martell's Spotify page now, she's got millions of monthly listeners, as with everybody else who's featured all of
crazy.
A sudden.
It's crazy. They went up 400%. Mm. One of the things I love so much about Beyoncé, there's lots of criticisms of pop female artists of a certain ilk, like of this certain status, right, who very rarely have other female guest vocalists. When Beyoncé does, they're not singing background vocals for her. they are singing the song with her, the Miley Cyrus duet, Two Most Wanted.
Miley starts the song.
They're line for line, back and forth with each other, right? But Beyoncé is always taking people with her. So you have those four women featured on Blackbird, and then you have Linda Martell, and you have Willie Jones, and you have Shamboozy, and now they are all in the top artist charts for the first time in their careers because they were featured on this. There's an interlude on here called The Linda Martell Show that leads into the song Ya Ya, and she has one of the most specific and, I think, critically important pieces of spoken word on this album. No disrespect to Willie Nelson, who's like, have a good time, I don't know, peace out. But Linda talks about genres, and she goes, genres are a funny little concept, aren't they?
Yeah, and the interesting, Linda Martell started off as a pop singer and was convinced to go into country and then experienced some short-lived success. But then when she lost her backing, it all kind of went pear-shaped. And she ended up, you know, just doing regular jobs like driving a school bus. And I'm telling you all this now because I listened to the album and I read an article. And so, like, this kind of cycle of knowledge just keeps passing on, which is also really interesting. But thinking about how Beyoncé's story could have been like that in a different generation, I think it's actually quite humbling for an artist of her stature to put herself in that trajectory and acknowledge the past and where she is and what she's able to do, sadly, because somebody else tried but was in the wrong period of time and couldn't do the same thing.
Well, you look at a song like 16 Carriages, which was one of the first two singles released from this album. It is essentially done to a chain gang rhythm. So it is a working song. And it's about her having to get on the tour bus when she's 15 and go out there and go on the road and leave her mother and leave her father and see essentially fame corrupt her family, overworked and underpaid. Then by the end of the song, she's 38 summers and she's not in her bed, overworked, not underpaid anymore, but overwhelmed. You know, and I think that's really fascinating. It's like, you don't just get to be Beyoncé. You have to grind it out. There's that famous quote that everyone, it got memed like nonstop around the Ryan Gosling, Hey Girl era, where it was like, you have the same amount of hours in the day as Beyoncé. And it's like, yes, but Beyoncé has been in her stilettos in this game since she was 15 years old. And before that, you know all the stories of her father, Matthew Knowles, having her and Kelly Rowland and the other girls out there doing
practicing
while singing so they could get their breath control. They have been grinding for a really, really long time.
Earlier this week, Beyoncé accepted the Innovator Award at the iHeart Radio Awards, presented to her by Stevie Wonder, who, by the way, just casually played harmonica on Beyoncé's cover of Jolene.
Innovation starts with a dream, but then you have to execute that dream, and that road can be very bumpy. Being an innovator is seeing what everyone believes is impossible. Being an innovator often means being criticized, which often will test your mental strength. Being an innovator is leaning on faith and trusting that God will catch you and guide you. So, to all the record labels, every radio station, every award show, my hope is that we're more open to the joy and liberation that comes from enjoying art with no preconceived notions.
There's a lot of subtext to what she's saying there. You know, every time Beyoncé actually opens her mouth and says words into a microphone, it's kind of a big deal because she doesn't. We mostly hear her singing. That's where her message comes from.
And that's intentional, too, because there was a period of time where Beyoncé and her team sat down and essentially assessed how she was presented and perceived publicly. And they were decided that interviews don't serve her. If she can't define herself in her own words, then she will not be speaking. So when she's receiving something like this, she like set the standard for the industry.
I think mental strength, you almost hear that break in her voice when she says that. Oh, I caught my breath because I was like, it's rare to see Beyoncé break even a little bit. And then when she says, my hope is that the industry award ceremonies, I was like, where's this going to go? Is she going to take it high or is she going to, you know, have a little kick like Jay-Z, her husband, did at the Grammys themselves? And she kept it, Michelle Obama, she kept it high. But we know the subtext and the history of that, right? So do you think, I know it's just early days, but do you think Cowboy Carter will get nominated for Album of the Year at the Grammys?
Yes.
Do you think she will win?
She's the most nominated artist in Grammy history. Do I think she'll win? I can't even begin to guess what these crazy white people are going to do. Like, I truly just, she should have won 20 times ago. Like, I don't even want to get into it. But this is an interesting point, though, because it leads into some of the criticisms that I've seen about Cowboy Carter and Beyoncé at this particular moment in time, largely from black writers and black critics. There was a piece by Doreen St. Felix where essentially she was saying, because there's some pot shots towards the Grammys and things like that on the album, but also post the innovative speech, they're saying that even trying to not pander to those awards bodies, but even being transparent and saying that you want this thing, they think that that is beneath her. Mm-hmm. If they can't get it and they can't jump on board the Beyoncé horse, they can't get on board Chardonnay or Renee, then they don't get to come to the rodeo. And that's what's fascinating, is that so much of the, I guess, critique that I've seen in Cowboy Carter era have all been about, why should she even pander these people in the first place? Don't pander to them.
I don't think she's pandering. I don't think she's pandering.
That's their critique. Yeah. That's not mine. That's some of the pieces that I have seen in the New York Times, in the New Yorker, on Vulture. Just been some really interesting thoughts, particularly from black writers and black critics who are just like, she's above this. I go to those ceremonies ever again.
I would be very surprised to see her making any kind of overt plea. That, like what we heard in that Innovators Award speech is probably the closest, is that she's like, I have a hope. This is my dream kind of thing. You know what I have been looking at, though, and I'm thinking, like, Beyoncé has been so smart as ever with the features and the duets, right? Mm. Like, she's bringing people along, emerging, who she thinks the world should know about. But she's also, like, enlisting, like, Dolly Parton. Dolly Parton is country music. If anybody goes against Dolly, they are going against country music. They are basically blaspheming. So to have Dolly on this album and then have Dolly say that she loves this version of Jolene is huge. And then you have people like the daughter of Johnny Cash and June Carter Cash, Carlene Carter, claiming Beyoncé as a Carter girl. Mm-hmm. Like, it doesn't get more country than that. It's incredible.
It's pretty amazing. And this is why oftentimes I like sit and think to myself on the tram or while I'm surfing or swimming or just like trying to dissociate from working out. I'm so fortunate to be alive in the time of Beyoncé. The LA Times called her one of the most intellectually ambitious artists of her generation. I love the word ambitious because it's, you're always striving for something. And that's one of the things I love about Beyoncé. She's always striving. Yeah. She's not just striving to give you a country album. She's striving to give you a history lesson in America, period, but in American music.
You know, she's a woman in her 40s in her prime. I love to see it. What did you think of that version of Jolene? Because I thought, so interesting, like she did with Blackbird, right? Mm. Which is more straight ahead cover. Like, just the nuances that she changes. Because, you know, Dolly Parton's Jolene is from an era and she's pleading. Mm-hmm. I'm begging you, please don't take my man.
Beyonce is a warning, baby.
I'm warning you, don't take my man. And that experience of, like, I'm a woman too. I know these games.
Yeah, she's a banshee bitch.
I know. And then Dolly in the intro, she, like, invokes Becky with the good hair, Hussy with the good hair. There's so much going on there.
So much going on there. And also I think the duration is really interesting because there's been a lot of talk lately about how albums these days are so much shorter because the idea is the shorter the album, the more people are playing them, right? So shorter songs, shorter albums means that the more time somebody's playing it, the higher it's getting up on streams. You're racking up numbers, you're racking up the charts.
Mercenary.
Right. The Jolene cover, along with several songs on Cowboy Carter, are long. Many of them exceed 4 minutes. Some of them are closer to five.
There's 27 tracks total.
Right. And, you know, like a lot
kind of
interludes
of 30
on there.
Seconds, but still, that's a lot.
Yeah. And I think that is one of the things that I find so interesting. She did a signing in Tokyo over the weekend. Which again,
can you imagine if you just showed up and then Beyoncé's there?
Die.
To signing your album.
I would have died dead.
I did see some
R.I.P.
of the photos of the fans. They
so
looked
cute.
Hysterical.
So cute. They were the most polite, like, obsessed fans ever. They were like wide-eyed, smiling, doing the
yeah,
moves
it's incredible.
From,
yeah.
from Texas Hold'em. But from that signing, she was talking about believing that people want complicated music and believing that people want songs with bridges and want songs with lengthy verses and want songs that shift and alternate pace and rhythm. And they want ambitious
music. But by this time,
music.
She's trained listeners, right? Because when Renaissance came out, she was very much like, she didn't like Spotify putting it on shuffle. And what did they do? They took it off that auto shuffle. Mm. And she's like, I want this album to be listened from beginning to end. And so that's what we did. And then when Cowboy Carter came out, I didn't need to be instructed. I was like, obviously Beyonce wants me to listen to this from American Requiem all the way down. So that is what I will do.
I kept wanting to go, Just for Fun is my favorite song
from the
album.
Don't you dare shuffle. Don't you dare shuffle.
And I can't start at it Just for Fun, because then you miss the lead in to Just for Fun. Then you miss the build up into each of her songs. The transitions are so important. She has all these sound bites as well from legends of American music that have passed, people like Chuck Berry, stuff like that. But it's this interspersing of work and people and ideas and concepts and meaning. She's just truly like an artist of her time. This is Beyonce's weirdest album by a mile. I remember like starting American Requiem at midnight, like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. And then you're like, what the hell? Like,
yeah, you can't expect or predict what's going to come next based on what you're listening to.
No, like people freaking out about the opera. It's like, you know, she did that in Ave Maria. She's performed.
But there's also a point to it because it's inspired by spaghetti westerns.
Exactly. But she like performed an opera at the Oscars over 10 years ago. You know, these are things within her canon. But hearing Beyonce sing the way Jimi Hendrix plays was not what I was expecting. You know, we know Tina Turner's obviously was one of her mentors and a lifelong influence. But there's so many things on this album that I was like, this is so weird. And this honestly feels like one of the first albums that Beyonce has made in quite a long time where she has really exposed and opened herself up to critique. Mm-hmm. Because it is super weird in parts, because it is so ambitious, because it is so broad and eclectic. I guess only time will tell. It'll be really fascinating, you know, in 10 years' time, if the world still exists, how we look back on this album and how we look back on it in its positioning in her career and what comes from it. Because one of the things I really want to reiterate again on that Blackbird cover, the women that she features, Tana, Brittany, Tiara, and Raina Roberts, who's amazing. She has amazing red hair. Those four women specifically, they have only popped up in the music scene post Daddy Lessons, right? So they are a particular type of black female country artist that is specifically inspired by and harkening back to one country song that Beyonce did on an album from 10 years ago, right? And so that's her legacy from that one song. So what's the legacy in 10 years from mm-hmm. this album? If it encourages people to be weirder, I love that. If it encourages people to make longer albums, brilliant. If it encourages people to write songs not just about their personal experience or who broke up with who or what situation happened there.
Not to name names or anything.
No, I mean lots
just
of...
Just generally.
Beyonce's written those songs, you yep. know what I mean? But she's also expanded her songwriting and expanded her storytelling. She is a storyteller.
And let's also see if, you know, like she said in that Innovators Award speech, like what our award ceremony is going to be like. If you're exploding genres mm-hmm. left, right, and center, then, yeah. you know, you have to actually assess the structure of it all.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then this is Act Two. We know Act Three is coming. There's a lot of fan theories. Beyonce's not going to tell us, obviously. She's going to choose her multi-million dollar moment to release that.
She has been telling us, though.
Well, right. She has. You're right. She has been telling us mm-hmm. all along that she's been country. But I think there's a huge clue.
I think she's also been telling us what's coming as well.
Yeah,
in that innovative
I think
speech.
Is a big hint also mm-hmm. of what's to come, right? Because that's not really a country song. It starts with Nancy Sinatra, you know, These Boots Were Made for Walking. That's a pop song. And then you hear some Beach Boys in there. And you hear a lot of things in there. I think I hear like Elvis in there when mm-hmm. she kind of goes low and does Elvis voice. So this is...
Well, Elvis's OG inspiration is in there, which I found really interesting. No Elvis samples, but only his inspos, which were... Black artists. Mm-hmm.
That's right. So I think we have and Tina Turner, she puts on the Tina Turner voice. I think we
Rosetta.
Have an idea of what Act Three may contain, right? What are the fan theories saying about that?
The last time I popped up and Stop Everything, we talked about Act One being Renaissance, Act Two being Reclamation, and Act Three potentially being Revolution, and that leaning itself most closely to rock. And in the same way that when you listen to Cowboy Carter, you can hear Renaissance in there, mm-hmm. particularly the last 4 to 5 songs from Riverdance.
Is it Riverdance?
Onwards,
yeah, you can see that sonic
she
connection.
She makes the
yeah.
sonic connection. Mm-hmm. That's such a beautiful way to explain it, Beverly. Oh my God, thank God. Thank God you're the culture correspondent. Like, this is what we come here for. We come to this place
it's a
for
mutual,
magic.
No, and so it's you or Miley, Beyonce. I'll be Miley. I'll be Miley. That's all right.
But I think, quote unquote, sonically, she's showing us on Cowboy Carter where she's going
yeah.
with a lot of those rock inspirations and the rock influences. And I think that's where we'll head. Again, this is not something unusual. If you've heard songs like Sugar Mama, for instance, a real Beyonce deep cut, she's done it. She's doing it.
Okay. Cowboy Carter, do we feel spent? Do we feel like we got enough for now? We're okay. Are we sated?
Are we laying in the dirt at the radio? Chardonnay and Renee trample on us.
Rodeo clowns are just like, enough already, enough already. You got 8 seconds.
Are we the rodeo clowns, question mark?
Possibly. You know what? If I was hired to be the rodeo clown in Beyonce's, I would just be like, yes, I will do any job. Speaking of which, give me the dirtiest job, I will do it.
When I was a boy, my mother used to tell me a story of a demon king and his army. They brought fire and terror to the land. Until they faced the protector of the people, the white monkey.
That's not Act 4, the tabla version of things. That's Dev Patel, everybody's sweetheart, in Monkey Man, which we've both seen. And this is Dev Patel's, he stars in it. He helped write the screenplay. And it's his I can never say that word.
Directorial debut. And
thank
he
you.
Produced it as well.
Yes.
Let's get him in there.
What do we think?
I loved it.
Yeah.
And also, I just have to say, I feel like anytime people see the two of us rock up to a screening, they're like, ugh, here come these mouthy broads again. Because our row, no, it is. It is. We got shushed in that screening of The Batman, and I'll never forget because we were both groaning so loudly.
Oh.
But as we were watching the Monkey Man screening, excitedly squealing, jumping up and down in our seats.
I was too tense with the stabbing. You know, I love a good fight movie. I love the choreography. Mm. We have differing opinions on John Wick, but I do really enjoy the choreography. But also, like, it's a real trade-off for me because the stabbing and the puncturing of those movies, I always have to, like, look through my fingers and my whole body is tense. But I still will say, I liked it. That's part and parcel, but you got to sacrifice.
I truly think it is an astounding directorial debut. I know Dev Patel's been
in this. It's hugely ambitious.
It's insanely ambitious.
Yeah.
It's crazy ambitious. But also, keeping in mind, like, this is an multi-Academy Award nominee, right? Dev Patel is in a very specific league, as in he is a critically acclaimed acteur, thespian, if you will. Oh, I don't know why I turned French. And for his directorial debut, he's not doing some serious, low-risk drama.
He's doing action.
That people would expect
from
him.
He's in basically the entire movie, so he's got to direct and act.
And to tie this into Beyonce, he's doing an ambitious, sweeping film that ties in mythology, martial arts, and modern action filmmaking. Honestly, the way it is sold in the trailer, which I think is fantastic, it's going to get butts and seats. That's great. We want it to do big numbers. So people will be in studios in particular, like Netflix, will be in car because this was a Netflix movie
originally.
Well, this
wasn't supposed to be in theaters, right?
It wasn't. It was a Netflix movie, and there were some issues in the post-production stages of that, shall we say. And Jordan Peele saw a screening of it and was so motivated by its brilliance and its ambition that he ended up essentially buying the movie through Monkey Paw Productions, which is his company, and planning a wide theatrical
There's
release.
A really good quote from a friend of the program, Wenli Ma. Mm.
We love Wenli.
We like to shout out our guest critics.
She needs to be in our row.
Part of the family. She's interviewed Dev Patel for The Nightly, the website that she writes for. And it's this great quote Dev Patel said, it was like a scene in Pretty Woman. Jordan is like Richard Gere. I always turn away from this nice shop in Rodeo Drive, and then Jordan gives me the black Amex card, which is Universal Pictures. And I get to go in and have the second go of things. It's pretty amazing. Isn't that fantastic? Also, like, black filmmaker sees what a British Indian filmmaker is doing, gets that out in theaters. And I think that trailer is very interesting, too, because it's long. But it does not spoil what happens. Like, no. I watched Madam Web, and they put the key finale moment in the trailer.
Yes, but that's because superhero movies are risk-averse, and that is a situation, a conversation of its own.
That's just a mere small side note. Let's stick to Monkey Man.
The thing with Monkey Man, the trailer, is they're like, hey, man, white people love that Punjabi MC song. We're going to put that in the trailer. So that will get them in there. A little slither
was,
of Jay-Z.
It was so dated when they did that. I can't believe they're putting that in. They understand.
They understand what the people want. They understand what they want to get butts in seats. Right? And if this was a theatrical success, it means that more movies like this will get made. It means that Jordan Peele has more carte blanche to pick other filmmakers of color and support their work means Dev Patel gets to be ambitious and go on to do other stuff. What's really fascinating is this is his declaration of, I am a movie star. Yes, everybody knows I can act and I can carry a movie, but people are not giving me these movie star opportunities unless it's something quite weird and experimental like Green Knight. And so now you get something like this, and it's super exciting because this is why diversity matters at all stages of creativity. If you don't have somebody who's almost a studio head, like a Jordan Peele, an Oscar winner, you don't get somebody in that position to be like, I'm going to save your film and I'm going to put it out wide. And the Jordan Peele brand, he is one of those few directors like a Tarantino, like a Greta Gerwig, who people hear that name and they will go see a film based on his name alone.
Well, just to bring it back to Cowboy Carter for a second, Nope is part of this kind of culture-wide, I've seen it described as reinscribing of the Black identity back onto Western movies, country music, cowboy culture, all of that.
Can we go even further? Nope, which is Sky Jaws, and I will stand by that to the day I die, stars Daniel Kaluuya, right? Daniel Kaluuya, Dev Patel's one of his longest-term best friends because they were both in Skins together and cast from the same London housing area in their first ever professional jobs.
We love to see this full circle conversation.
Full circle.
Bring it back. Maria Lewis, I love having you on the show. It's a privilege. It's a pleasure. Book in again.
Can I book in? Let's see. It was 2 years between Renaissance, Act 1, and then into Cowboy
Carter 2. I'll book you in for Act 3 now.
Yeah, so book me in for 2026, babes.
Okay, all
right.
Let's
say January 17, 2026.
Can we hope to have you in before 2026 as well? Maria Lewis, pop culture etymologist, award-winning and best-selling author, filmmaker. Maria is currently developing a feature film project called The Black Talons. It's a comedy horror about a girls' netball team fighting for their lives in a Captain Cook-themed public housing tower infested with reptilian monsters. I love the way your imagination works, Maria Lewis. Thank you.
That Captain Cook housing tower, real place. Real place in Sydney.
Australia. Okay. Anyway, this episode of Stop Everything was made on the land of the Kulin Nation and on the land of the Muwinina people from country around Nipaluna. Stop Everything is produced by Sarah Mashman. Our executive producer is Tom Wright. Our sound engineer is David LeMay. Thank you so much for hanging out with us on Stop Everything. We are always available on the ABC Listen app and all the major podcasting apps. I will catch you next time.